We're pleased to welcome you to our first lecture in the series of On a World in Change. We've been delaying just a moment because all of this is in large part made possible by Mrs. Blanca Rosenstiel, and we're terribly grateful. Maybe my eyesight, but I don't see her, but if she comes in, why, we'll find other ways to express our gratitude. I have two introductions, one short, of which the speaker would prefer, if not its content, its length, and the other slightly longer, one for the benefit of those of you who may not know Professor Kurbanski. The shorter one is that on several occasions, both in New York and in at the dedication of the Annenberg Center at the University of Southern California, in which we both participated, I left the meeting with Professor Kurbanski saying, this is somebody whom, if it were ever possible, I would like to have as a colleague. What makes that rather remarkable is the fact that, come in, we're delighted. We've told them that you've had a hand in all this, but we did. Won't you come down with Professor Kurbanski? I was just saying, Blanca, that we're much indebted to you for this series, and I began by introducing Professor Kurbanski in a short way and said that when we participated in several programs and I left him, the thought that remained in my mind was, this is a man I would like to have as a colleague. What makes that remarkable is the fact that our mentors were not only intellectual but personal adversaries, and we also represented Macy's and Gimbel's in New York, he for the Ford Foundation and I for the Rockefeller Foundation. So this close affinity is in spite of, rather than because of, our origins. The longer version is to tell you that Professor Andreas Kurbanski was born in Poland. He served in the Polish underground from 1942 to 1944. He was a prisoner of war in Germany from 1944 to 1945, and then served with the Polish Army in Great Britain, and not having had enough, with the United States Army from 1951 to 1953. He received his Bachelor of Science in Economics from the University of London and both his Master's and PhD degrees from Columbia University. He has been a member of the faculty, professor of political science at UCLA, in a career that began in 1963, a career in which he distinguished himself not only for his research, but continues to teach a very large course on Soviet affairs that has attracted wide attention. He was a program officer of the Ford Foundation for European and International Affairs. He was co-director for the RAND UCLA Center for Soviet Studies. He's director of the Center for Russian, and continues to be, of the Center for Russian and East European Studies at UCLA. He was appointed U.S. member to the Belgrade CSC follow-up conference after the Helsinki conference. He served on numerous editorial boards and professional societies. He's done important publications and writings in the field of international relations and Soviet studies. And one that is of particular interest is a joint publication with Francis Fukuyama, who has become widely known for his essay on the end of history. This book being a study of the role of the Soviets in the Third World. So it is a great personal privilege and honor and an event of distinction for the Miller Center that Professor Kurbanski will talk with us about change in Eastern Europe, a topic that couldn't be more timely.
Thank you, Professor Thompson, Lady Blanca, ladies and gentlemen. Let me first of all say how delighted I'm to be at the university, not only because it's the first time, but perhaps mostly because I happen to be in the Jefferson's Rotunda. And well, something I'm going to discuss a bit later, but Jefferson, and particularly Jeffersonian democracy, as a model, has become quite an object of discussions in Eastern Europe. I think the connection is perhaps particularly relevant for my talk today. What I'd like to do for the next 40 minutes or so, to share with you my own impressions, comments, ideas about the what may be called simply the process of democratization of communism, communist societies in Eastern Europe, transition to democracy, collapse of communism, whichever. A process which began, of course, had its origin a good many years ago, but in fact achieved its full intensity, well, roughly about a year ago, and in a sense has continued until today. So I would like, first of all, perhaps to say a few things about what I consider to have been the main reasons, triggers, factors, causes behind the upheaval taking place at that particular time, then say something about the current state of affairs in Eastern Europe, and then, with considerable risk, to look at my crystal ball and speculate about the future of Eastern Europe in the next few years. Now, I'll try, above all, to cover the six countries of Eastern Europe, alphabetically Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, East Germany, Hungary, Poland, and Romania. I will have something to say about the Soviet Union, but I will not, for example, focus my attention on Poland, because I understand from Professor Thompson that later this week there will be a real authority on Poland speaking at the university, our current ambassador to Warsaw, John Davis, whom I had the honor and pleasure of knowing for quite a while, and he, more than anyone else, is in a position to tell you things that I probably don't even know or don't even suspect. So if you have the time, please do come and listen to him, because he's not only a marvelous speaker, but also a very, very knowledgeable person, probably maybe the most knowledgeable person about Poland in this country at the present time. So what happened? I mean, what actually made the upheaval possible? Well, you know, it's not an easy question to answer, because, as you know, things happen very, very quickly. And even today, roughly 12, 14 months after the event, we still have great difficulty sort of coming up with a model or some sort of a set of conditions, factors, which would really explain to our satisfaction why, after 40 years, the communist system just collapsed almost overnight. And I suspect it will take us quite a while before we are able to come up with a sensible, rational, satisfactory explanation. Archives still have to be opened. We would still have to interview many of the actors who participated in the actual decision making. Things happened fast. It happened so fast that, of course, we, and here I include myself, I guess I sort of fancied myself after almost 30 years of working in the East European vineyard that I will not be surprised, that I will know when things are about to happen. Well, I didn't. And I think together with, I presume, not only the White House, National Security Council, CIA, and everybody else who's been in this business, we got caught with our pants down. We simply didn't expect things to happen. Sure, I've been to all kinds of conferences, even a year ago, and people were talking about incremental change, slow, gradual, step by step, some liberalization of the communist system, but not collapse. Really, when people sort of talked in terms of democratization, well, maybe sometimes in the 21st century. So, you know, one question, which of course we do not have time to discuss today, is why were we so surprised? Because for someone like myself, as I said, toiling in the field for decades, this is not an unimportant question. Is everything that we taught our students wrong? Was our methodology simply outdated? Why didn't we see the signals, which apparently were, after all, sent? Did we talk to the wrong people? Perhaps, you know, the whole, quote, science, unquote, of Sovietology or communist studies is due for a major sort of reappraisal and reevaluation, perestroika, if you wish. But as I said, this is not what I want to talk about today, but perhaps a topic for a conference, in fact. Sure, I think we can say something about being conservative and communist states still being essentially closed societies, that our information was not perfect. But in any way, I think we should be sort of ashamed a little bit, I think. I am, to be sure. But anyway, let's try at least and briefly look at what, at least in my opinion, were the chief causes, the chief sort of reasons that triggered this process. Most of them, I think, can be put on, under the rubric of domestic or internal causes. There are a couple, I think, quite important external ones, which I also want to mention. I can, again, to simply save us time, I would identify three major domestic causes and discuss them very briefly. I think the first one, and then in no particular order of importance or relevance, I think the first one clearly was the disastrous economic situation, which I think all of us who have traveled to Eastern Europe can testify to. And it's not so much even perhaps the absolute level of poverty or of misery, but is the relative ones, that after 40 years of communism, there really has been no improvement, quite the opposite. There's been a deterioration, that whereas, let's say, the communist system may have worked at the beginning with sort of a rapid industrialization, with an attempt to move these countries which, let's say, prior to communist takeover were backward, underdeveloped, peasants, and so on, and at least establish some kind of industrial basis. But by sort of the mid-60s, it appeared that the system really could not deliver, that it had to be changed, that the rapid rate of economic growth, which among other things, I think was responsible for very impressive mobility, migration from countryside to the cities, mobility in the sense that peasant and workers' kids for the first time in their history could go to a university, end up being doctors, lawyers, engineers, and whatnot. And that, by the way, and let's not kid ourselves about it, certainly caused a good deal of support for the regime among, let's say, the previously underprivileged masses. But this thing only lasted for a while, and I dare say sometimes in the mid to late 60s, the rate of growth suddenly began to drop. Obviously, the old highly centralized system was failing and had to be replaced. And as a result, as some of you may know, a number of countries, including the Soviet Union, did attempt to introduce a series of economic reforms in an attempt to put the economy back on its track, to at least perhaps reduce somehow the central controls, introduce some elements of market mechanism, and above all, I think, ensure a reasonable sort of standard of living. This was becoming very, very important because at the same time, more and more people from Eastern Europe began to travel to Western Europe. They would come back totally astonished at the gap in the living standards between them and, let's say, their fellow citizens, fellow Europeans on the other side of the Elbe. So politically, not only economically, but politically, this became a major issue. Well, the reforms failed. I think by hindsight, we can say that by and large, they tended to be cosmetic, simply tried to remedy perhaps the worst offenses, but not really address the major issue, so that by 1970s, another attempt was made to improve the economy, and that was, of course, mass infusion of Western credits, mostly from West European banks, a bit from the US, in an attempt, again, to pay for the modernization of the industrial base, for the importation of know-how and technology, and so on and so forth. Money was available. These were the petrodollars that the Arabs were investing and looking for a place to invest. Until then, both Soviet Union and Eastern Europe have had a very good reputation as reliable, let's say, borrowers, always repaying things on time. So this was almost a riskless operation. No guarantees were asked and none given. Well, we know what happened. Again, that failed. Some progress was made, but on the other hand, it appeared that investing billions and billions of dollars into economies which still refused to reform proved to be mostly wasteful. A good deal of it was simply eaten. Most of it was used to import grain, meat, other consumer goods, therefore making communist regimes popular. But again, despite we're talking about 40, 50 billion dollars at 1972 prices. So today, obviously, it was a much larger amount. Again, it seems to me, nothing much happened. So that the beginning of the 80s, first in Poland, but gradually elsewhere, I think failure of the government to deliver on the economic front has become a very, very important political issue. Again, in Poland, of course, perhaps the emergence of solidarity, an attempt by the working class to do something, was a case in point. I think everywhere else, the governments were also losing support left and right because of, as I said, initially contributing to what may be called the revolution of rising expectations, and then two or three decades later being essentially totally unable to fulfill these expectations. The gap between East and West kept growing. What was perhaps even more significant, things looked hopeless. There was really no hope unless the system were to be totally wiped out, totally sort of eliminated. So I think the economic factors were. Number two, which is, of course, they all interrelated. The second, I think, factor that I consider as very important is what I call simply alienation of intellectuals and youth. Both groups, very important. You know, the position, the status of intellectuals in Eastern Europe has historically always been much higher than this country, where, let's say, writers, poets, composers, painters, even musicians, tended not only to be producers of cultural goods, but also leaders. They were the standard bearers. They were the carriers of national traditions. They were the ones that at times when these countries were, let's say, under foreign occupation, they were the ones to preserve the continuity. And that's why we have Mr. Havel, a playwright, a president, Mr. Mazowiecki, a journalist, the Prime Minister of Poland, and all kinds of other people. The current Prime Minister of Hungary was also head of a museum in Budapest. Things, I guess, unheard of in the US, but quite common in Eastern Europe. And again, it seems to me that the attitude of intellectuals to communism underwent some very, very significant change initially. And again, let's face it, I don't particularly like to talk about it, but it has to be said. I would say 90 to 95% of East European intellectuals sold out to the communists for whatever reason. Again, we don't have time to discuss it. I presume most of it was for purely opportunistic reasons, apartments, trips abroad, cars, privileges, also perhaps the ability to, or at least ability to be printed and published. It wasn't a pretty picture, but I would say somewhere between 1945 and, say, the death of Stalin, that's essentially has been the problem. However, since the mid-50s, things changed almost completely for a variety of reasons. The same intellectuals who were perfectly willing to write poems honoring Stalin and Beria and various others became increasingly leaders of the dissident movements, and so much so that in some countries, of course, they became the leaders. Initially, again, I suspect that the communists did not take it too seriously because the sheer numbers were not very significant, even though their, let's say, popular impact was quite striking. But again, when in 1976, again in Poland, the intellectuals for the first time got together with the workers in the form of creating something called the Workers' Defense Committee, that was perhaps the major sign that things were changing very drastically. And again, 4 years later came Solidarity, where again, on the one hand, Mr. Wałęsa, who's, despite his latest shenanigans, is still my hero, surrounded himself by intellectual advisors. So you had a combination which was essentially unbeatable. You had the masses, you had the workers, and you had, of course, also the intellectuals. So when that happened, and on top of that, of course, you had also the youth, and the situation with the young people was almost identical with that of the intellectuals. Initially, the young people, again, were kind of carried away by the early promises of communism. They all would join the Komsomol, the Young Communist League. They would participate in all these fantastic enterprises that were characteristic of the sort of a revolutionary period. But again, after the mid-50s came the disillusionment, tremendous crisis of credibility. And it's still, I find it quite pathetic when you read, even today, letters of young people accusing the party of betrayal, of lies, and so on and so forth. So that from being the chief supporters of the communist regime, the young people, the students, the young generation in general, as well as the intellectuals, simply reversed their position and became the chief critics of the party. Then, of course, you can, in some countries, you can still add to it other institutions such as the church, let's say, and others. But I would say the two groups, intellectuals and young people, were by far more important. And finally, I think the final reason again for the collapse, I think, can be found in the ruling party itself. That after 40 years of rule, I think the communists simply lost their will. Simply found themselves faced with, again, inability to continue. See, again, historically speaking, the people who participated in the takeover were ambitious, were, I think, knew what, at least they thought they knew what they wanted. They were determined to create new societies in Eastern Europe. They were well united, well integrated, and so on and so forth. But gradually, once that generation died out, increasingly the character of these parties changed. And instead of being sort of a truly revolutionary state and nation builders, increasingly these parties became heavily bureaucratized, opportunistic, corrupt. So much so that when in the 60s and 70s, for the first time, they became faced with trouble, they really didn't know what to do. And they tried half measures, such as, say, partial economic reforms, some perhaps political reforms, but most of them stuck to what obviously by that time became outdated, antiquated ideas, less and less relevant to, let's say, the last two decades of the 20th century. And increasingly, the gap between the party, the rulers, and the rule became enormous, with no possibility of bridging. And when finally, I mean, talking now about the 1980s, the last, say, two or three years, when, let's say, these communist parties really became under pressure in Poland, in Hungary, in East Germany, and elsewhere, they simply collapsed. And they collapsed really overnight. I'll never forget when I opened the newspaper on October 8, 1989, and there was a photograph of Mr. Gorbachev and Honecker in East Berlin and a parade of goose-stepping East German soldiers. This was October 8th. And the country looked, and I was in East Berlin a few months earlier, things looked absolutely stable, immutable, and all that. And yet we know that a week later, Honecker was out, and East Germany simply began its collapse. Same thing in Czechoslovakia. On October 27th, you could still see pictures of policemen beating up demonstrators on Václavské náměstí. A few days later, things changed. And here again, I think the parties simply could not cope. They were rotten to the core, corrupt. I think they simply realized they failed in their mission. They also failed to attract what you may call the best and the brightest. And it was remarkable how meekly they kind of gave way and allowed themselves to be ousted. So again, it seems to me it says something about the character of what used to be a kind of a totalitarian party, but which in time simply gradually began to disintegrate and ultimately simply found itself unable to generate enough of a political will, for example, to offer some meaningful changes or to respond to popular demands. So that's essentially those three factors. Very briefly about the outside factors. Well, here I have absolutely no hesitation, of course, to bring up Mr. Gorbachev, mainly because as a student of East European history, I only have to compare his behavior during the critical months of 1989 and the behavior of his predecessors, such as Khrushchev, who had no hesitation to send Soviet troops into Budapest, or Brezhnev, who not only, of course, squashed the Prague Spring, but then justified by issuing his so-called Brezhnev Doctrine, which for the next, say, 20 years or so, apparently represented the formula that the Soviets were going to use each time there was to be some kind of a trouble in Eastern Europe. The Brezhnev Doctrine, which simply stated that the Soviets had the inherent right to intervene in the internal affairs of any communist country if, in the eyes of the Kremlin, communism in these countries was threatened with destruction, oblivion, and whatnot. I mentioned Hungary, I mentioned Czechoslovakia. I think there is a well-known, well-documented fact that at four different occasions, the Soviet army was poised to enter Poland in 1881. And why they didn't is still, to some extent, a mystery, except that, of course, the Poles themselves imposed martial law and spared the Soviets the trouble of invading. Yet, Gorbachev, and of course the provocation offered by Eastern Europe was far greater than the trouble in Hungary or in Czechoslovakia, which were at that time isolated, only single countries, and so on. Here you had not only Poland, but you had just about every other country in the process of getting rid of their communist rulers, and yet the Soviets did not stir. In fact, again, I'm being told that in many instances, they almost encouraged negotiations involving communists and non-communists, which ultimately led to the disappearance of communist rule in the name of, quote, stability. In my conversations with the Soviets, sometimes at a very high level, in 1988 and 1989, stability was the name of the game. And this perhaps also provides an explanation why Gorbachev did not move, partly because perhaps he realized that he had enough at home, and that he simply could not do both, could not reform the Soviet Union and deal with the nationalist problems and reform the economy and introduce glasnost, and at the same time worry about the situation in six other East European countries. Also at the time when he was determined to improve relations with us, to bring us to the conference table, to reduce defense expenditure to, in order to reallocate some of the budgetary resources, say, to consumer goods and so on and so forth. I see not an explanation. I'm not saying that Gorbachev is a sweetheart or that he simply loves Eastern Europe. He's not. Anyone who owed his career to KGB cannot be viewed as a tender-hearted fellow. I think this was a fairly cold calculations. I think he realized sometime, perhaps not only in 89, but sooner, that Eastern Europe was becoming a burden and that the Soviet Union might as well unload it, especially if in this way it would earn the gratitude of Western Europe, Eastern Europe, and possibly the United States. I think the second external factor, I think it's us, is the US, is the West. Again, I wouldn't go that far as to say, as some people say, that it was all the doing of Ronald Reagan, that in fact he was responsible for what happened in Eastern Europe, not the East Europeans, not Gorbachev. Well, I'm not willing to buy that. But the fact is, it's not only Reagan, but also his predecessors and the United States, which somehow throughout the entire post-war period remained as a symbol. It never quite abandoned Eastern Europe. It tried to sometimes, perhaps, not very smartly, to maintain its presence, to influence conditions there. But its support of the radios, for example, I think was a marvelous thing. And also the various exchanges, cultural, educational, and so on and so forth. Same thing for Western Europe. It seems to me as long as the East Europeans knew about us and knew about Western Europe, that we offered the alternative, that I think was a very, very powerful factor in their belief that sooner or later, perhaps, they would be able to get rid of communism and to... Okay, so much for the causes. Now, what about the situation today? Well, as I said, Jeffersonian democracy is now a very, very popular slogan in Eastern Europe. And of course, again, those of you who may have followed the developments in the region, of course, must be aware that the very first thing that the new regimes demanded was free elections. And indeed, we had free elections now in Hungary and in East Germany. We're about to have them in Bulgaria and Czechoslovakia. Poland had semi-free elections in June of last year. But I think the result of those free or half-free elections, those thus far and those again to be held in the next 2 or 3 weeks, is that they would essentially ratify the collapse of communism in the region, because, and again, in perfectly free elections, the communists throughout the region so far managed to get anywhere from 5 to 10% of popular vote. And as a result, in most of the countries, the traditional communist parties have now dissolved themselves, split very often to two or three different ones, some retaining the old name, most of them adopting a new one. So again, it's a rather remarkable process where within less than a year, the previously all-powerful ruling oligarchies, ruling parties, are today reduced to a status of not a very important opposition party, let's say. And it's not at all inconceivable that in a few years they will simply disappear completely from the political arena. That's the good news. Now, the other news, not so good, is, of course, that, again, as was to be expected, the collapse of communism was followed by an incredible proliferation in the number of political parties, clubs, associations, and so on and so forth. Not only those commonly found in Western Europe, so national liberal, Christian Democrats, peasants, social Democrats, and all that, but of course all kinds of others less known. For example, the Green Party is now one of the most popular parties. Not surprisingly, any one of you who have seen the pollution in Eastern Europe will understand why, but all kinds of even far-right, semi-fascist, anti-Semitic organizations, sort of comparable to the Pamiat in the Soviet Union. And as I said, some remnants of the sort of a Trotskyite revolutionary left wing, and also groups and associations representing the nudists and the gays and lesbians and all kinds of others, 30, 40, 50 sometimes. I think in Hungary, 30 odd parties, I think, participated in the elections, in Czechoslovakia, maybe even more. Again, it's understandable. I think it's not a very healthy sign, but in the short run, perhaps acceptable. I have more to say about it later on. It's all called pluralism. And this is something which of course, many of the dissidents were fighting for, simply to eliminate the single party monopoly and replace it with pluralistic. And they have it, with a vengeance. I think the other changes that have taken place, of course, is the total abolition of censorship, and that meant, again, explosion in the number of newspapers, weeklies, and monthlies, again, representing all kinds of points of view. Radio and television for 40 years under strict control of Communist Party is now, again, open and has become a very, very interesting medium. So that's again, for the first time in 40, 50 years, we have now in Eastern Europe totally free media, totally free press, very important. Political reforms, otherwise, well, economic reforms, very interesting, considerable difference of opinion across the spectrum. From Poland adopting very much a Milton Friedman model of almost 19th century laissez-faire capitalism with overnight the various restrictions imposed by communist central planners being removed, price controls, subsidies, controls on trade, controls on employment, they introduced so-called internal convertibility of Polish currency, and so on and so forth. Very controversial, very, I would say, forward-looking model. So far, after, well, 4.5 months of operation, it's still too early to tell. The Western economists, particularly those affiliated with the World Bank and International Monetary Fund, are praising Poland to the hilt. That Poland was the only country to take the plunge, risk unemployment, risk reduction of in output, and so on. Indeed, unemployment has increased, production has gone down, but I guess there's still hope that what will emerge at the end would be a kind of a Polish economic miracle, comparable to that in Germany after World War II and Ludwig Erhard in 1948, having reformed the currency, succeeded within 2 or 3 years in achieving a rather remarkable recovery. Again, as I said, the economic indicators are still not fully clear about the success or failures. However, despite, again, the hardships, which clearly the new model has brought about, have not reduced the popularity of the government, which is still, I think, enjoys a good deal of support. We'll see what happens. Elsewhere, for example, in Hungary and in Czechoslovakia, there is a good deal of debate whether to adopt the Polish model, so-called, or whether to do it incrementally, step by step. So far, no decision has been reached. There is, in other words, a certain fear that maybe the Poles could do it because they have a government which is very popular and enjoys mass support. President Havel apparently favors some reforms, but his more conservative supporters, many of them former communists, are worried. The same thing apparently applies in Hungary. East Germany, of course, has nothing to worry about since it's being swallowed anyway by West Germany. I don't know how many of you read this very, very interesting account 2 or 3 days ago, why Gorbachev did not, for example, adopt the Polish model. He apparently was interested, but the feeling was that this would cause so much unrest in the Soviet Union, which at the present time, faced with problems in the Baltics and elsewhere, simply could not afford it. I think it's bad, because I think that simply means that the Soviet economy was going to go from bad to worse. Politically, well, as I said, there were some reforms, free elections, obviously political pluralism, and so on. Constitutions are being rewritten, so that there is movement also on that side. Now, conclude, what about the future? Well, I wish I could tell you that the future looks very bright and that there's absolutely nothing to worry about, and that really we should sort of relax and things will sort of take care of by themselves. I'm only moderately optimistic, and the reasons why are the following. First of all, again, as an amateur historian of the region, I cannot help noticing that very, very, very few of these countries ever had much of a democratic experience. It doesn't mean that they didn't have it in the 18th or 19th century, but I'm talking about the 20th century. I'm talking mostly about the interwar period, which is the period that we really could use, perhaps, as for comparison. If you recall, many of them started after Versailles, having democratic constitutions, democratic regimes, free elections, and so on and so forth. But within 5 or 6 years, with maybe a single exception of Czechoslovakia, and even that is not a very good one, all of these, Yugoslavia, Poland, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, all of them were taken over by some sort of one-party military bureaucratic authoritarian regime. And what worries me is that there is much talk about Jeffersonian democracy, but very little understanding of it. And even in Poland, which in many respects seems to be more advanced than most because it had more of a political dialogue and discourse, and more opposition, longer than just about any other country, when you ask people, what do you mean by democracy, for example, or what do you mean by something called the civic society, which many people view as a sine qua non, as a necessary condition for a successful democracy, they don't know how to answer it. They simply talk of free elections, multi-party system, this, that, and so on. But for example, when you ask them, well, what about tolerance of other people's views? What about compromise? They look at you and say, compromise? Compromise is still a dirty word in Eastern Europe. I mean, compromise means compromising your principles. You don't do that. You stick to your principles. Otherwise, you're a coward or you surrender, let's say. That makes dialogue very difficult. And reaching some kind of a modus vivendi and understanding. And that's why I think we see this happening, not only, obviously, in a country like Romania, which I think daily is going from bad to worse, and was perhaps the most extreme, I think, example, where the defeat of the Ceausescu's, I don't think, has really changed all that much, maybe made even the situation worse. And in Hungary, I was told, for example, during the election campaign, there was very little consensus, in fact, and a lot of anger, a lot of not only anti-Semitic, anti-Romanian, but even certain class kind of antagonism being violently articulated. I hear things are happening in Czechoslovakia, which do not inspire much optimism prior to elections, let's say, even though it's not reported so much in the US press, but when you read some European press, particularly German press, is again a situation which leaves much cause to worry. And even in Poland, what I worry is, the growing disagreement among individuals who are responsible for the overthrow of communism. Again, it's a question of, I guess, turf and a question of power and a question of this. Simply, it's clear there's lack of experience. Everything's relative, but when you sit in this, in this rotunda, it took us 200 years in this country to really develop, you can say, a full-fledged democracy. Even that, some people will tell you, it's not perfect. It took the Brits about that long, since the Glorious Revolution of 1688. So maybe we shouldn't expect too much of the East Europeans. I think I see a growing gap between sort of a promise and fulfillment. There is a lot of talk and a lot of nice things are being written, but when you get down to the nitty-gritty of the politics, to the dirty kind of a side, I think there are worries. I think the second reason, I think, is the economic situation, because everybody will tell you, it's fine, all these beautiful scenarios, they may all probably be fulfilled, but we still have to feed these people, and we still have to employ them, and we still have to at least deliver the minimum, the modicum. Well, as I said, the drastic, albeit controversial Polish model is supposed to be a shortcut for that, and God knows I wish it will succeed, but if not, I do not exclude the possibility, not only in Poland, I think the same thing is true elsewhere. I do not exclude the possibility that unless there is a quantum improvement in the economic situation, that somebody will suddenly appear on a white horse, wave the flag and say, democracy isn't any better than communism, why don't we try something else? And back to, let's say, some kind of a pre-war model of military, bureaucratic, authoritarian, one-party system. Not, mind you, Stalinist totalitarianism, but clearly a far cry from Jeffersonian democracy. The little things, again, to mention the New York Times. Well, the other day there was a story about Polish peasants who produced too many potatoes. And they said, well, this never happened under communism, that we had too much, and they are rotting in the field. Or because they could be forced to sell to the Soviets almost at any price, and now the Soviets are more picky and not buying it. So here is the situation in the Soviet Union. Because right now, as long it seems to me, as Mr. Gorbachev is in control, I think Eastern Europe is not likely to be affected. Obviously, he's got enough to worry with Lithuania and the other Baltic countries than to pay much attention, let's say, to Eastern Europe. The fact that the Kremlin let East Germany go without really much preconditions is the case in point. That they are weak. They simply not in a position to do much. But if, by any chance, there is a change in the Kremlin, and let's say, I'm not talking necessarily about either Yeltsin or Ligachev taking over, but some combination of, again, the military, bureaucracy, and so on and so forth. I don't know whether they will be willing to accept the current situation and not to try to reimpose Soviet control, not to utilize the Warsaw Pact, which still exists, after all, has not been denounced. Who knows? I mean, I don't think it's likely. My feeling is that if indeed there is a change in the Kremlin, some of these changes that have taken place in Eastern Europe have been accepted as permanent. But there is always this certain probability, maybe very low, that Gorbachev is not, a year or two ago I would not have said it, because he looked really pretty good, but increasingly I'm beginning to worry, and I'm not the only one, because people who come back from the Soviet Union tell me that everybody who used to be a strong supporter of Gorbachev either is no longer, or is increasingly pessimistic about long-term survival of the current team in the Kremlin. So, to conclude, it's been a very exciting time, particularly for someone like myself, who, as I said, has been working in the East European vineyard for 30 years, and together with my colleagues, we always were kind of suffering from a certain inferiority complex, that things were happening in the Middle East and Africa and China, even in the Soviet Union, nothing in Eastern Europe, but finally something is happening. And I'm glad I'm still young enough to be able to take it all in, to enjoy the change, to be able at least to try to explain it. But perhaps as a parting thought, things just happened too fast, maybe it had to be that way. Perhaps there was no way of arranging for the demise of communism gradually, that it had to be kind of. As I try to point out, there are some danger signals ahead, frankly, I wish we here in the U.S. could do something about it. I think we really have better leverage, because money alone will not do it. So let's just hope that nothing happened, but at the same time, I want to leave you with the notion that things perhaps are not as rosy as some of our own media are sometimes prone to present. Thank you.
Professor Karbonsky has indicated he would be willing to answer questions. Who'd like to ask the first question? Mr. Brzezinski.
Yes, in implementing what you describe and describe as Jeffersonian democracy, first, will a Western model of Pat James, the bureaucrat on Paris, is about the American model of the Supreme Court or the French model of the Constitution?
Well, to begin with, insofar as constitution models are concerned, the only country which I think has started working on it was Poland, and until now at least, the major constitutional revisions that were adopted by the so-called roundtable negotiations in April of 1989 point to the French model. I mean, the current occupant of the presidency, General Jaruzelski, essentially, if you look at his prerogatives, veto power, his relations with the two chambers, and so on and so forth, is very, very close, certainly to the, not to ours, but to the French model. I don't know, I think all of these countries are now in the process of rewriting their constitutions, which as you know, until now, were essentially based on the Stalinist constitution of 1952, with some changes in the 50s and 60s. I suspect that when all the constitutional engineering is over, that most of them, I think, will probably choose again the French rather than the US. But this is not my, as I said, strong forte. East European constitutionalism, so you got me at a disadvantage. Insofar as the judicial review is concerned, to the best of my knowledge, this has not been known at all in Eastern Europe. I think Yugoslavia was the only country which I think in the either 50s or 60s has established a constitutional court. I guess mostly to mediate between various republics rather than engage in the proper sort of judicial review. I'm not aware of a kind of a Supreme Court, Constitutional Court, or say the French, you know, type of tribunal to be present anywhere else. The Poles were talking about it, but this is all very, very new and very much in sort of, I think, the many, many experiments being in the process. Somebody told me the other day that there was a big conference somewhere in Hungary, maybe or Czechoslovakia, where they invited, I don't know, 40 or 50 constitutional lawyers from Europe exactly to discuss some of the things that you raised. I'm already too long answering your question, but see, that doesn't worry me so much, whether it be that constitution or this model or that model, you know, the Germans in 48, 49 had to go through this process and it's been working pretty well. I'm really more concerned about, as I said, the civic society aspect. Are these people really ready for... Because I tell you, as someone who's also interested in German politics, I simply cannot help remembering, you know, the Weimar Constitution, which everybody hailed as the model of constitutional engineering, and only lasted, what, 14 years. If the people are not ready, you may have all kinds of beautifully crafted documents, and won't help very much. That, I think, concerns me more. Are these societies ready, or do they need really another generation, perhaps, of sort of a slow, careful kind of, you know, learning process? I think that's what's needed. So I know it's not a good answer, but that's as well as I can do. Yes, sir.
I want to ask a question about private property. Can you really have system
where the
public, the state owns the property, and do you see a model over
there of a trend towards privatization? Yeah. Listen, I mean, privatization is almost like Jeffersonian democracy. I mean, these are the two most popular concepts that, you know, you cannot read a Czechoslovak or Hungarian or other paper, you have article after article about the need to do it, how to do it, this, that. So it's become a buzzword. The trouble is, I think, and well, I don't quite disagree with you that you cannot have a democratic society with state ownership. I mean, you had a lot of it in England at some point before Mrs. Thatcher decided to unload it, and you had still quite a few of it in France and in Italy, and so on, and all of them are democratic countries. The question is how much, and perhaps a proper kind of a proportion between state and private. I see the privatization drive as perhaps mission impossible in the short run. Who the hell would ever buy dilapidated steel plants in Eastern Europe with the technology of the 1950s, really good enough mainly to pollute the atmosphere, but not really good for anything else, producing low quality steel? Who's going to buy it? I mean, look, we had trouble with it, and when you're here in this lovely Virginia, but you go to Ohio or go to Indiana and look at some of these places in Toledo or in Gary, I mean, it's old hat to us. But we had to go through it, and we are rich enough not only to sort of afford simply to let go, but also to retrain our workers and so on. But these countries, who will buy, you know, the Nova Huta or the Lenin's steel plant or this enormous steel plant, so used to be Stalin's steel plant outside of Budapest. So I think a lot of it will never happen. Other industries, as shown by the example of Hungary, where GE and GM already bought in, upon the Hungarians claim that they got ripped off, that we got it too cheap. And there are some perhaps other industries, more modern, more consumer-oriented, that may find some buyers. But other than that, I think it's going to be a very, very, very slow process. At some point, you know, look, these countries, with some exception perhaps, have now moved to the third world status, or maybe even fourth world status. I mean, all you have to do is compare, let's say, Poland with South Korea. Look at the South Korea and Poland 1960, or even 1970. Poland there, South Korea, now it's... South Korea is the most modern producer of steel, most modern producer of ships. All right, it's not a democratic country, to be sure. But it's one of the most efficient countries in the world. It's no longer a third world country. It's a NIC. It's a new industrialized country. In the meantime, Poland and Hungary and Romania just went all the way down. It will take a long, long, long time for them to even recoup the place they had about 20 years ago. So I think there will always be a state sector. You know, it's interesting because Sweden, for a long time, used to be the model. Now it's Italy. Because Italy is you know, it's a lot of state-owned proper, particularly energy field, electricity, oil, gas, and various natural resources, and also quite a few mama and papa shops. So you have this kind of a combination of large-scale state enterprises and small-scale, and that seems to be right now a very attractive kind of a model. But I think it will take a long time, unless, again, there is some kind of a tremendous sort of mass support from the West, which is not likely to come, because you really would have to be head examined to buy an East European factory right now.
Is it possible you'll have to have a great deal more economic stability?
Well, I try to address this issue. It's, you know, it's a chicken and egg. It seems to me that many of the drastic economic reforms, which are clearly needed to wipe out the legacy, the 40-year legacy, simply required a legitimate government. I mean, you know, when I mentioned this sort of a really radical, revolutionary, free sort of a competitive free market model in Poland, if the communists tried to do it, they would have a revolution on their hand. And it was only possible because the government introduced, discussed it openly in parliament. It was the government that was elected and is supported still by, I think, the prime minister by 66%, which is not bad, 2/3 of the population. But remember, each time the communists tried to do something, at least I'm talking about Poland, in 1956, they had bloody riots. In 1970, on the coast, bloody riots. In 76, and in 81. So, I mean, there's a long history. And I think it became quite clear that the chief precondition for major economic reforms that would not just be cosmetic, kind of a superficial, but would really go to the heart as the reform is going, you have to have a government that the masses trust. That's legitimate. You know, the word legitimate is a kind of a funny one, but it means you know, a government, a regime that is voluntarily accepted without coercion, without repression, because people trust it. People believe it, that for once it's honest and it's going to deliver. Even if it doesn't work out, at least the dialogue, the discussion was in the open. They knew it was not done in sort of a smoke-filled closed rooms, but it was part of the open debate. Apparently, Gorbachev, who as recently as about a month ago thought seriously about doing exactly the same thing, was then advised by his advisors this would create a total mess and revolution in Russia, because they don't have this legitimacy. They don't have the support. Therefore, he decided, well, no price changes for 3 years, okay? So the price of Soviet bread in 1992 will be the same one that it was 30 years ago. This is the only country where I think price of bread and meat and various other things have not changed in 30 years. Please.
Is there any sign in any of the Eastern
Royalist? Well, I think it's an interesting question. Well, you heard about King Carol, who wanted to go for Easter, I guess, to Romania, and he almost got there, but at the last minute he was advised not to. His daughters could go, but not him. Well, I talked to some of my Romanian colleagues, and they said, well, you know, he really is kind of a weakling, and his record as king, let's say, and also his behavior did not particularly predestine him to play a major role. Although at this present time, when Romania is in such a mess, he may be the only one that could do something. Insofar as Bulgaria is concerned, I have not seen any references. I think some members may have come and visit. In Hungary, well, I think jocularly they were talking about Otto Habsburg perhaps to be elected king of Hungary, and he apparently came also. He's now the deputy to the European Parliament and actually quite popular. I know you remember when Empress Zita died, 300,000 Hungarians showed up in Vienna for the funeral, which means that there is still some kind of a sentiment. Czechoslovakia, well, they haven't a king, what, since God knows since when. In Poland, I haven't heard anything except that the aristocracy is now beginning to meet and is beginning to sue the government for the return of some of their estates. At least, I think, in the case of one Prince Lubomirski, who already recovered, and the others, and a member of perhaps the best known Polish aristocratic family is now Anna Radziwiłł is in the Senate. But I think it's sort of marginal. Sometimes newspapers write about it and people kind of like to read about it, like, you know, society gossip. But I think that republicanism, I think, is rather firmly embedded in Eastern Europe. Please.
Are you familiar with Hedrick Smith's?
Yes, indeed.
Travel through the rural districts far from the stronghold of these inner communists. Still, the people don't quite.
Sure. I don't know, for those of you who may not have heard the question or statement, every Monday night for the past 3 weeks, Hedrick Smith has had a program on the Gorbachev's Russia or USSR on public television, and I must say I've been watching it with great interest, and the most recent one on Monday, part of it was devoted to this miserable state of Soviet agriculture. Well, I think it's not only true, I wouldn't be surprised if perhaps even overstated. In other words, I think conditions are even worse than presented. He was talking about, I think, Russia reasonably well equipped with machinery and not too far from... No, I think, let's face it, Soviet agriculture is absolutely the Achilles heel of the Soviet system, and I think it's going to remain that way for a long, long time. And I think the degree of mistrust between, say, the kolkhozniki, the members of the collective farms, and I presume the same goes for the workers of the state farms, and the regime, I think is unbreachable. To me, good example, of course, of the total lack of trust is the fact that so far, at least, the Gorbachev's offers, to lease some of the land to the peasants, and then to pay the peasants in hard currency for delivery, apparently has not, of farm products, has not found much response. I think it's now well established by Western economists that the Soviet agriculture is also a tremendously costly sector, that if you look at the state budget, Soviet budget, which is of course has a worse deficit than we have even, I understand, a lot of it is due to huge subsidies offered to Soviet agriculture, still not very helpful. In terms of labor intensity, about 2 or 3% of our people are employed in agriculture, and they not only feed us, but also export a lot of stuff. So in the Soviet Union, what, 1/3 of labor is still in agriculture? So that itself tells the story. And then when, as Hedrick Smith showed, the waste, the lack of refrigeration, transportation equipment, and so on and so forth, means that probably up to maybe 25% of the harvest gets lost, gets wasted simply. I really see absolutely no future in it unless there is some kind of a recovery of basic trust. But nobody believes. I think the peasants, Soviet peasants, were treated ever since collectivization, so we are talking now about 70 years, from 60 years, from 19, say, late 20s to the present time, as an underclass. They were persecuted, discriminated, not rewarded, always treated as I said, lower than everybody else. Why all of a sudden these people should feel any different just because Gorbachev is singing a sweet song and so on? So as one of my colleagues at Berkeley once said, if the Soviets were really smart, they would completely abandon agriculture and buy everything from us. They're already buying plenty, but it'll be cheaper from them if they simply bought it from Kansas and Iowa, and then try to have their own people produce at a tremendous cost. Economically, it really doesn't make sense. It'll never happen politically, because that would be such a tremendous sort of acknowledgement of defeat. But I think that's pretty much what's been happening. It's a disaster, let's put it this way. And so far, Perestroika made it even worse. I don't see any kind of improvement. Everybody who, for example, I have many, many friends who emigrated from the Soviet Union in the, say, early 70s, from places like Odessa, Kiev, Leningrad, and so on. Now the all-American citizens, they go back, and they come back horrified how life has deteriorated in, say, 10 to 15 years since their departure. When you have people in big cities outside Moscow not seeing meat for 6 months, and the only thing they can get is some rotten potatoes, maybe, or some half-spoiled milk, and everything else has to be bought at the black market or the collective farm market, well, it tells you something about it.
One more question. David?
What role do you see the European community as playing in the continued change?
Well, I tell you, I don't know that much about it, but it seems to me that, first of all, as you probably heard, as you probably know, the Soviets tried a long time ago to create a kind of, well, I think it was always, I think rather incorrectly, referred to as the East European Common Market. I'm talking about CEMA or something called COMECON or Council for Mutual Economic Assistance, I think, which was an attempt at least to coordinate trade and production and all that. Well, that's, again, dismal failure. After 40 years of its existence, I think it's still maintained, but I think it's going to disappear from the political arena. This in itself, of course, meant that East Europeans increasingly were interested in common market, of course, a resounding success. For a long time, the Soviets simply prohibited any kind of a formal relationship between Eastern Europe and Brussels. For a long time, none of the East European countries would formally recognize the existence, for example, and would not send representatives and this and that. But as things began to unravel after 85, country after country would come to Brussels and initiate not only, let's say, not only would recognize the existence, but also would negotiate a treaty which would offer the East Europeans sort of a certain kind of privileges, but comparable to those, you know, on the loan convention for the African countries and so on, so that they do not pay the highest duties and they do have a little bit of a privilege. Of course, 1992 speeded up the process because that obviously worries the East Europeans. I think ideally many of them would love to be included into EEC, but that's not going to happen, not for a long time, because I think that already some of the EEC people are not too happy about East Germany to begin with. Also, some of the poorer members are already concerned. I'm talking about Ireland and Spain and Portugal, Greece, because many of the funds that apparently were going to be earmarked for economic development may now go to Eastern Europe, East Germany. Since Germany is the main supplier of these funds, you know, they're going to probably prefer East Germany than Ireland. I think I think what's likely to happen in the next 10 years, there'll be gradual rapprochement. There is some suggestion, for example, that perhaps rather than joining EEC, perhaps the East European countries should join EFTRA, you know, like with Sweden and so on. Hungary has expressed some interest in it. Clearly, I think this is what we can expect. They already rejoined the IMF and the World Bank. Not all of them. The Soviets, just, as you may have read, just got an observer status in GATT. So that's the. I think it would be sort of a slow process of rapprochement, but I don't expect EEC, for example, to open up its doors and invite more people, because that's already, they're worried about coordination and so on. Other than that, you know, they're already helping. They already provided, what, $800 million for Poland and about $600, I think, for Hungary, and probably more becoming. And they have, after all, their mountains of butter, mountains of meat, and some of it already, I think, has been also sent to Eastern Europe. But I do not see any kind of a dramatic changes beyond that.
We've gone on longer than we normally do. Lady Blanca and I would like to invite you on Friday of this week to attend the second in the Rosenseal series, a discussion by Ambassador Davis at 11 in the morning at the Miller Center. As our speaker has said, he is perhaps the best informed American on some of the developments, having had 4 diplomatic appointments in Poland, and then moving from being chargé to being ambassador there. He will be retiring, as I understand it. There'll be others in the series. Professor Philandra is the great criminal law specialist. We hope Professor Garlitsky. But in order to learn about them, you have to come on Friday. So we hope all of you will put on your calendar 11 o'clock on Friday of this week at the Miller Center. Duma Malone often spoke in this place. I happened to sit between him and a lady who was pressing him very vigorously for some cause one evening. And he turned to her and said, I believe above all in balance. We've heard a presentation this afternoon, whether you agree with each proposition or disagree with it, it has been characterized by balance. It was that balance at the Annenberg Center and other contacts which I've had with our speaker which led me to believe to live with such a person would not, in a university setting, would not be at all difficult. And it has not been at all difficult for us this afternoon to hear this very insightful and balanced, both hopeful and realistic account of what to expect in the months and years ahead. We thank you very much.
Thank you.